This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation. Mystery Hour with James O'Brien.
5 minutes after 12 is the time, and here it is, your weekly opportunity to achieve the sort of satisfaction not ordinarily available anywhere else on your radio dial. If you haven't listened before, trust me, it's fun. And goodness knows we've needed it, haven't we, over the last couple of years. It was always a pleasure to slip into something a little more light-hearted than the normal news agenda, but given that the news agenda has been so grisly so recently, it's been doubly valuable, I think. How does it work? Pretty straightforward. Ring in with a question. Somebody else listening will then ring in with an answer. The only rule, really, is that if you're going to ring in with an answer, you have to know it straight up. I don't care how you know it. I'll check. I'll seek your qualifications, which can be anything from I saw it on telly last night to I'm the Professor of the Public Understanding of Science at the University of Brighton. Equally valid qualifications. We just need to establish that you know it, because you're not allowed to look anything up. Mystery Hour is designed to hark back to bygone days, which is just a way of saying it's to make us old fogies feel a little bit better about the fact that all the stuff we learnt at school doesn't matter anymore, because our kids can find it out in the flick of a phone. All the sum total of human knowledge, several millennia of evolution, well, more than millennia of evolution, isn't it? But several millennia of intellectual adventure are all now distilled into microchips and servers and clouds. So the whole notion of education has changed without us really noticing. And Mystery Hour is an attempt to sort of hold back the tides of technology and still revere and respect learned knowledge, memorised knowledge almost. And I think it is valuable. I think it does have its place. But it's also very funny. So the only rule is you're not allowed to look anything up, whether online or in encyclopedias. But if you were reading the encyclopedia last week or last night and you happen to have that nugget of knowledge to hand, that's allowed. That is perfectly permissible. Should we just crack on, actually? Try and squeeze in a few more questions even than we usually manage, and spare the rubric, spare the terms and conditions. Remember, the number is always the same, 03456060973. But even more than usual, you do have to be patient, because it is very, very, very hard to get through. And we do our best. We have to churn. We have to turn over the switchboard more assiduously than we do for the other 14 hours of the week, because otherwise we'd never get any answers. Everyone would be ringing in with questions. So please, whoever you speak to, if you do ring in, please be polite and cognizant of the fact that this is the radio producer equivalent of spinning plates this hour. It's not just spinning plates. It's spinning plates on a unicycle while also playing the mouth organ. OK, that is what they're doing in the studio while you ring in. So please be polite and be mindful of that. 8 minutes after 12 is the time. John is in Bournemouth to kick things off. John, question or answer?
Oh, hello, James. First-time caller.
Welcome, John.
The question is, yeah, how is it that horses are able to sleep standing up?
Well, it's because they've got four legs.
Why don't they fall over when they're asleep?
Same reason tables don't.
Well, tables don't have brains.
Do you think there's the vaguest chance that my answer contains a scintilla of relevance?
No,
nor do I. Because, I mean, dogs have got four legs and cats have got four legs and lots of other mammals have got four legs, and none of them sleep standing up. The horses definitely sleep standing up. It's not one of those old childhood myths.
No, well, I heard Claire Balding.
Oh, well, it must be true.
Gives this as an explanation, watching the Olympics the other night.
They never lie down, horses.
Oh, they do.
Do they?
But if they're in a horse box travelling across Europe,
yeah,
for, you know, 3,000 miles, and they're standing up,
they can have a
kip. How do they go to sleep?
So how does it work? How can a horse sleep standing up? I like it. I mean, it's a similar theme to the questions we answered recently about how some birds can sleep while flying. So it's probably a sort of semi-animated state or something like that, but I don't know. I like the answer. Some of the commentary surrounding the dressage at the Olympics, deeply unfair, but quite funny. You know, the idea that all you do is get on a horse and whisper it. The easiest way to get a gold medal is you get on a horse and whisper, get on a very, very well-trained horse and then whisper in its ear, right, over to you, Dobbin. And then the horse goes off and does all that ballet stuff and you get a gold medal at the end of it. I thought it made me chuckle anyway. Absolutely inaccurate and deeply unfair, but quite funny. John, thank you. Lauren is in Ealing. Lauren, question or answer?
Question.
Carry on.
So people used to drink beer because it was safer than water back in hundreds of years ago.
Sort of.
But how did they how did they discover though that beer was better to drink than water if they hadn't made beer before? Would they accidentally kill themselves with the water and then had to find something else?
What do you mean if they hadn't made beer before?
Because someone had to make it at some point.
Yeah, but they didn't make it because it was safer to drink than water. They made it by accident, realised that it would probably not even tasty, realised that it got you drunk, and therefore tried to make it again. Are you familiar with Jon Snow?
I know of Jon Snow, yeah.
Which one?
Both.
There's three, actually.
Is there? Yes. Okay.
There is the
Jon Snow, yeah. But what I'm saying, I'm wondering is, like, they might have made it because it tasted nice, but when did they decide that? Because of the...
Well, I think Jon Snow, is relevant here. And I'm thinking of Jon Snow, the scientist, the cholera fellow, not the character from Game of Thrones or the doyen of newsreaders. So Jon Snow discovered that cholera was killing people by plotting a map of everybody who died or everyone who'd been affected by cholera and realising that they all live near a particular well, a particular water pump on Broadwick Street in London. That wouldn't have made it clear, because what clinched it was a woman who'd used to live around there, but she'd moved, I think, to Islington, and she caught it as well. And when he went to talk to her family, it turned out that she thought the water that came out of the pump but near Broadwick Street, where she used to live, was better than the water that came out of the pump in Islington, where she'd moved to. So her devoted sons used to bring her buckets of water from the Broadwick Street pump to Islington, and that's how he realised that the source of the cholera outbreak was the pump on Broadwick Street. And it was a huge breakthrough for science and epidemiology and all the rest of it. He discovered it was waterborne by studying that. So I presume that what happened was somebody just noticed that the fella over there who's drinking beer all the time didn't get sick when everybody else did. Everybody else was drinking water, but this lad was drinking beer and he didn't get sick. So they put two and two together, came up with four, and realised that it was drinking the beer, the fermentation process being a sort of form of purification. And that is how that they discovered it. So I very much doubt you'd be able to put a point on it like you can with Jon Snow and the Broadwick Street pump.
Yeah, so that's what I was going to say, because Jon Snow relatively was quite late, because it was after medieval, but you're right.
1854.
Exactly, so probably before that, whereas it's just water generally not being good, because people always say don't...
Water was dirty. Water was not purified, so they'd be drinking dirty water. And the beer, which was made using the dirty water, but of course by going through the fermentation process it would have been purified, it would have killed a lot of the bacteria, all of the bacteria, And they would just have realised that drinking small beer, it used to be called, very, very weak beer, not only quenched the thirst effectively, but also he didn't keel over. And everyone who'd been drinking out of the water bucket keeled over at tea time. That'll be all it is.
Yeah, I don't know why I don't think of it like that, but you don't need a specific event for people to notice.
No. It would have been like science. It would have been observing the available evidence and fitting a theory to it. The theory was, if you drink beer, you won't get sick. If you carry on drinking water, you will. Then they can test it by, you know, I don't know if they did test it, but it would have been tested naturally. Loads of people would have carried on drinking water. The fellas over there would have carried on drinking beer. They didn't get sick. They may have fallen over for other reasons, depending on how much beer they drank, but they weren't puking their guts up, and the fellas over there were. And that, I'm 99.9% sure, is your answer.
Yeah, it would just be good to try and pinpoint it. But
well, all right then, flipping heck. There's no pleasing you, is there? I just gave you a bit of history, a bit of Game of Thrones, a bit of Tour of Soho. I've given you everything here, and you want more?
I like the fact you talked about that lady who bought the buckets. That's very funny.
It's a lovely tale. It's one of my favourite stories. Yeah. And you can still see the pump if next time you're in town.
I've seen it, have you been down there?
And the pub right next to it is called?
I can't remember.
The Jon Snow, Lauren! The Jon Snow pump!
Thank you.
No, thank you. I'll leave it on there. Was there a point at which it was established that, if you like, turning water into beer removed the impurities and the dangerous bacteria from water? Otherwise, I'll take that round of applause myself, although I don't want to do any premature celebration. Nobody likes that. It's coming up to 12:15. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. How come horses can sleep standing up? And was there a point at which we discovered that beer was safer to drink than water in the days before, you know, water purification and chlorination and whatever the rest of it may involve. It's 12:15. If you're lucky enough to have some spare cash and quite fancy the idea of investing it, but, like me, don't know one end of the FTSE 100 from the other, then Nutmeg could have the answer. You just choose a risk level that suits you from a choice of four investment styles. It includes one that prioritises social responsibility, which would keep my kids happy, and let Nutmeg take care of everything else. They already manage £3.75 billion for about 140,000 customers, and they take all the mystery out of the process by committing to transparency and keeping everything as straightforward as possible. You can see how your funds are performing 24/7 via your computer or Nutmeg's mobile app. As with all investing, your capital is at risk.
Mystery Hour on LBC with James O'Brien. Call 0345 6060973.
17 minutes after 12 is the time. How come horses can sleep standing up? And I like this. That's the best answer I've ever heard, James. Why does a horse not fall over when it's asleep? Same reason the table doesn't. I still think I might turn out to be right on that one. And I also think I might get a round of applause for the when was it discovered that beer is safer than water question, although we're looking for specifics on that. And some of you pointing out it's not fermentation necessarily, but the boiling before the fermentation. I don't know. But the question that I think Lauren wanted was almost a date. When was it discovered that you could avoid waterborne diseases by drinking beer? Harry's in Willesden Green. Harry, question or answer?
Question, please, James.
Carry on, Harry.
So, as far as I'm aware, it's illegal to destroy money.
Is it? Are you sure? Hang on. The KLF set fire to £1 million once, didn't they?
I don't even know who that is, so that doesn't help. But
how old are you?
26.
Oh, this is happening time and time, more and more often. The KLF were like a really big band, and they set fire. Oh, it doesn't matter. Go on, carry on.
Did they get in trouble?
I don't know. I was just trying to remember.
Okay, that may answer the question, to be honest, because when you go to amusement parks or a place like that, you find those machines where you can put in a 1p and some other form of payment, and they kind of squish them into like novelty coins in print, like a logo of where you were.
Yes.
And assuming it was illegal to destroy money, I was questioning how that was legal.
See, I'm always wary of questions that are built upon an assumption. You see, Harry, that's the issue here. I don't, but it does. I mean, I know it's defacing Her Majesty's image, I think, would be the offence, would it?
Well, yeah,
maybe.
That's what I thought.
And I know the things you mean. One of my youngest went through a phase of loving them, and it used to drive me potty because you pay a pound to mutilate a penny.
Exactly. Surely, naturally, the political system is better. A penny's not worth a penny. It's based on kind of money being out in existence.
Yeah, so, no, of course.
You know, if you're
okay.
Writing
well, okay.
Currency,
well, I mean,
the
reason I don't like questions based on assumptions is that you're only allowed to ask one question, and if it's based on an assumption, you're essentially asking two, which is it illegal to deface money or to destroy money? And if it is, how come those machines, I don't want to get anyone into any trouble, but at places like Kew Gardens that charge you a quid to mutilate a penny and stamp a sort of commemorative motif on it, so it acts as a form of souvenir. How come they get away with it? I like the way your brain works. We'll try and find out, Harry. The phone line went a bit south at the moment, so I shall spare you a personal farewell. Kenny's on the Wirral. Honestly, you wait all week for a caller from the Wirral, and then two come along at once. Kenny, question or answer?
It's a question, James.
Carry on.
Out of all the sports that we have, I'm just wondering, why do we have umpires in some sports and in other sports we have referees? When they're basically both doing the same job. Like cricket, hockey, tennis have umpires, football, rugby.
Does hockey have an umpire? Are you sure hockey has an umpire?
Positive. That's what made me think of the question when I seen that.
And does the hockey umpire run around like a referee in football?
Absolutely, yes.
Because I was going to suggest that umpires stand still while referees run around. What do you have in snooker? It's a referee in snooker, isn't it, as well?
They hardly
run around, but they don't stand still.
No.
Yeah, all right. So, I like that question. We've probably done it before, but my memory's not up to the job of remembering what I had for breakfast, never mind what we did on the show 6 years ago. I shall try and find out. Is this inspired by watching the Olympics?
Absolutely, yes.
Isn't it? Okay. What's the difference between a referee and an umpire? Why do some sports have referees and other sports have umpires? I'm really looking forward to the answer to that one. Margaret is in Newton Abbott. Margaret, question or answer?
I have an answer for you, James.
Carry on.
It's the horses standing up one.
Oh, yes.
So horses don't actually sleep unless they're lying completely flat out.
Oh.
And they only need to do that 2 hours in every 24 hours,
is that
so
right?
To speak.
Gosh.
When you sort of see them in the field and they look like they're sleeping and they've got like one leg sort of looking a bit bandy at the back, they've actually got a mechanism in their hind legs that allows them to lock one of their hind legs.
Like a table. Like a table. Like a table.
Like a table.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. So they lock one hind leg and they can go into a sort of semi-catatonic state.
Semi, yeah. They'll only get proper REM sleep when they're actually laid completely flat out.
Oh, how interesting.
So you'd argue that they were resting rather than sleeping, standing up.
It's felt like my dad when he was watching telly and he used to nod off and then I'd wake him up and say, no, sir, I was just resting my eyelids. So
yeah,
they're resting their eyelids, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So when they're in the horse box, which is obviously what the questioner picked up on, something Claire Balding said, although, I mean, she would know, wouldn't she? She grew up surrounded by horses.
Yeah.
So he probably slightly misunderstood whatever it was she said. Then if they were going on a really long journey, could they lean if they were in the horse box?
To be honest, they don't go to sleep at all when they're in the horse box.
Oh.
They're continually sort of managing their balance with their legs, so their weight will be shifting across their legs all the time they're there, which is why there's limits on how long you can actually have a horse in a horse box or a trailer.
What is the limit?
Now you're asking.
Don't
it's
worry.
Not more than a few hours.
No, for that reason. So it's quite stressful for a horse then to be in a horse box.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. There's a lot of stress involved with travelling horses, definitely.
Fantastic answers. Qualifications?
Yeah. I actually lecture in equine science and I also research in it.
Really?
Yeah.
How many equine science lecturers are there in the country at the moment?
There's a fair few.
Oh,
talk
yourself out.
20, 30, maybe.
It's not many.
HE level, higher education,
what
degree
do you
level.
I mean, 20 or 30 equine science lecturers we give. We don't know, because if I gave you a Ray Liotta, I'd have to give Professor Hal a Ray Liotta every time he rings in, and that is weekly. So
it help that I did have a student who did some research on travelling horses?
On this very specific issue.
On how behaviour within the trailer and everything, because obviously it's really important to keep them happy as possible.
I think we should.
I'm Ray Liotta, and you're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. If you build it, they will come.
Great stuff, Margaret. And you get a round of applause as well. There we go. And that was a generous one, Margaret. It was a generous one, but I really liked your answer. Partly because it endorsed my theory of the table, although they're not actually sleeping when they lock that back leg. Lovely stuff. Chris is in Tooting. Chris, question or answer?
It's a question, James.
Carry on, Chris.
Do cats need to have sunshine to get their daily dose of vitamin D?
You're comparing them to other mammals. You're thinking that we get vitamin D via sunshine absorbed through our skin or whatever. I don't know what the science is. So because cats are covered in fur, you're wondering whether it works on them as well.
Well, no, my cat doesn't go out, you see, so I'm wondering if she needs a bit of vitamin D.
So could a cat... Well, I mean, how is she?
Sorry?
How is she? Is she all right? How's she looking?
Well, she's very fat.
Right.
Well,
that's because she doesn't get much exercise.
she's very fat, but apart from that, she's healthy.
So she's not got any vitamin D deficiency then, as far as we can tell?
I don't think so, no.
Well, you've kind of answered your own question then, Chris.
I just wondered, that's
no,
all.
If she was a plant, she'd need sunlight to do photosynthesis, but she's not a plant, she's a cat.
I really don't know how we absorb it through our skin.
Don't ask me. I'm just a gob on a stick on the radio. I presume we do. I mean, there's not much else we could absorb it through, is there? Through the eyes and the ears. I don't know. I wouldn't have thought. I shall find out for you. What does a cat who never goes outside? I'm trying to get the question phrased correctly. Does a cat who never goes outside run the risk of a vitamin D deficiency?
Yes, please.
You're very welcome. I shall find out for you.
Thank you.
No, thank you as well, Chris. And I maybe feed her a little bit less. You know, she just got to keep an eye on the old waistline. 12:26 is the time. Jane's in Walton upon Thames. Walton on Thames, even. Jane, question or answer?
Hi, I've got a question, James.
Carry on.
I don't understand why the word bi-weekly.
Yeah.
Why does that mean twice a month? Because that for me should be bi-monthly. A bi-weekly, I would have thought, would mean twice a week.
Well, where are you getting the idea that bi-weekly means twice a month from?
Because there's lots of meetings at the moment where they put it in as like bi-weekly and it happens once a fortnight. And I've tried to pick them up on it.
No,
and then
I've
Googled it and it says it can mean both and I don't understand why.
Well,
it's
just a linguistic glitch, like flammable and inflammable both mean exactly the same thing.
I looked that up, but apparently they don't mean exactly the same.
Oh, hang on a minute. Hang on a minute.
They apparently don't mean exactly the same. But your lovely lady who I spoke to, she also was perplexed.
I mean, you've already looked it up, so you know that you're right. It is the case that it can mean either. So you're trying to work out how it can mean either.
I
might struggle to explain this. You know when you can feel understanding in your head, but you can't necessarily get it out of your mouth. Does that ever happen to you?
Yeah,
I'm right there now. I'm feeling understanding in my noggin, but I don't know if I'm going to get it out of my gob, but I'll have a go. It's because the bi refers to two. So it could be referring to two within a week or 2 weeks. So it could be every 2 weeks. Or it could be twice. So it's the two. You need to focus on the bi, not the weekly, and think about how the two plays into the word weekly. And it can mean two things, ironically enough. It can mean either two times in a week, bi-weekly, or it can mean every 2 weeks, bi-weekly.
Doesn't the same apply for bi-monthly?
Well,
then?
I don't know, do I? I'm trying to answer your question. I can't come up with supplementaries. Well, it wouldn't work with bi-monthly because... Oh, you see what you mean? Why doesn't bi-monthly mean twice a month?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's a good job you didn't ring in with that question, isn't it? Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to answer it. I'm taking a round of applause for the other one, though. Jane, thank you very much.
Thank
you very much. There it is. And, of course, the more confident I am that I've provided a cracking answer to a question, the more likely it is that you will ring in a little later and set me straight in a steward's inquiry. So do feel free to do that on 03456060973. Cats and vitamin D, referees and umpires. What's the difference? Why do some sports have referees, other sports have umpires? Beer is safer than water. And we've done the horses, which I feel... I wasn't robbed of a round of applause on that one at all, was I? Because they do need to lie down to get proper REM sleep. I know that because a lecturer in equine science told me. Was there a point at which people realised beer was safer than water? It seems unlikely, but you never know. If you don't ask, you never find out. And do feel free to challenge that answer I gave about bi-weekly, although I think it was certainly not impregnable, but I think it was close to impressive. Thomas Watts is here now with your headlines.
Mystery Hour on LBC with James O'Brien. Call 0345 6060973.
It is 26 minutes to one. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Mystery Hour continues. Questions still in need of answers. I reminded you just before the news, so I'll just remind you of the phone number now in case you can answer any of them. 03456060973. If you can answer any of the questions on the board, or it's 26 minutes to one, so you've still got plenty of time to get your own question on the board as well. Bob's in Durham. Bob, question or answer?
It's an answer, James. Good afternoon.
Carry on.
It's an answer to your beer and the pump water.
Right.
You were absolutely right that it was John Snow who observed that people contracted, was it cholera, I believe?
Yes, it was indeed.
And he observed that, but he observed at the same time that the local brewery workers who were literally across the road from where the pump was did not get cholera. The reason being, they drank the beer. And how you make beer...
Even though the water came from the same pump?
The water was from the same pump. So how you make beer, it's called liquor into water, and you combine that with the malted grains.
Yes.
But that's at about between about 60 to 70 degrees centigrade, which it's, and that doesn't actually kill the bacteria. It may do, but it could still be there. But then what you do is you boil it with hops.
Yes.
To flavour the beer. And boiling the water kills all the bacteria.
And that is... I have already corrected that, to be honest, although you probably picked up your phone before I did so. So the I said fermentation, right? It's the boiling process that would kill...
In that case, yeah.
But is the bit about the broad... No, don't worry about that. I'm fascinated by the bit about the... So had it not been scientifically demonstrated prior to... Because that would be amazing if it was down to Jon Snow. I mean, literally, as opposed to theoretically, the beer was part of the discovery with regards to cholera.
Well, indeed, the water had been boiled, whereas the people drinking the pump water, they didn't boil the water. And you're right. Originally, it was believed that it was called malaria. It was bad air.
And it would be the workers in the brewery, and he'd have thought, well, hang on, why aren't they getting it? And
indeed.
They'd say, well, we don't really drink water; we only drink beer.
We only drink beer, yeah.
Oh,
and as you say,
wow!
It was small beer. Yeah, and so he thought he realised then that it was the pump water causing it all, because originally before that, people had believed that it was bad air.
Right, yes, they had. That's right, exactly, they had.
Indeed, yeah.
And so waterborne disease, establishing that cholera was a waterborne disease was his...
Indeed, that was it.
Well,
yeah.
Lauren wanted a date. I already gave it to her. 1854 would be, I think, the year that Jon Snow did.
You're very knowledgeable. I didn't know the date.
It's only because it's literally one of my favourite little spots in Soho.
Right.
And there's a very nice, if you're ever in town, Bob, there's a very nice little Spanish restaurant just over the road. Does an absolutely, does an absolutely delicious croquetas. What are your qualifications?
I used to work in a brewery on a small Scottish island.
Did you?
Yes.
That sounds like fun.
On the Isle of Arran.
How delightful.
Indeed, yes, it was, yeah.
Was it just sort of special beer, or was it just...
Well, yeah, they do some very nice beers. Just normal beer. But, yeah, you know.
Should we share this round of applause, or do you want it all for yourself? It's entirely up to you.
I'll share it with you, because you did correct yourself. But
did,
you weren't totally sure whether it was the boiling or not.
I wasn't. But also, actually, no, you get this one, because that bit about the brawl, there you go. That's all for you, Bob. That was absolutely
thanks,
fascinating.
James.
No, thank you. That's lovely, that. And it adds to the Jon Snow story as well. It's just legendary stuff. Joe's in St Helens. Joe, question or answer?
Question.
Carry on.
Right, basically, when you get wind inside your body, like trapped wind, or just wind in general, what actually happens inside your body that decides whether it comes out of your mouth or it comes out of the other end?
Okay. So, yeah, so what? I mean, what's the difference between a trump and a belt, really?
Yeah, basically, like what happens actually inside your body that decides where that gas is going to come out?
It's probably pre- and post-digestion gases.
Think.
Yeah, probably, but I don't know. Did you hear the caller earlier in the week, the farmer who is he was telling us about specially bred breeding sheep?
No.
There was a farmer on earlier in the week. Did you know they're breeding sheep to make them break wind less?
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
That was a fascinating call. You can get it on the website, Joe. It's serious. I mean, I'm just presuming you've got a particular interest in flatulence.
No, it's just something that was just pondering around my mind.
No, fair enough. I bet everyone's wondered that at some point in proceedings. So when you've got wind, what determines whether it comes, pardon me for being so rude, it was not me, it was my food. It just popped up to say hello and now it's gone back down below. Or Johnny Fartpants. Which one is it? 0345 6060973. I like that. Tim's in Leeds. Tim, question or answer?
Hi, James. Answer.
Carry on, Tim.
So it's the one about the cats and vitamin D.
Oh, good, because I think we had a very concerned owner about this one.
Yeah. So cats don't absorb any vitamin D from the sun whatsoever. They get it all from the diet. So cat food is loaded up with vitamin D because they don't absorb it in the same way that humans do. I'd know this because we've had cats all of my adult life. I've got a cat now that's actually lying in the sun on the balcony, funny enough. But we used to have to put sunscreen on one of our cats because he used to burn.
And, really? What, was it a particularly short-haired cat?
Yeah, he was short-haired and he was white. So his ears had that sort of pinkish tinge And it used to get a little bit crispy in the summer.
Oh.
So we used to have to put sunscreen on his ears to stop him burning. And we'd ask the vet, you know, do they actually need the sun? And although they don't need it for vitamin D, there is some degree of thought that actually a lack of sunlight in cats can cause depression.
Oh, no, really?
But nothing to do with the vitamin D, yeah.
Well, it might be a seasonal affective disorder or something like that.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
The same, feline same equivalent.
Yeah.
Qualifications?
I've had cats for 27 years.
And so you've just looked into it, and also having the cat who was susceptible to sunburn would have focused
and
your mind on
it. So really, the vet deserves a round of applause, really, many years ago.
How do you know you've had cats for 27 years? How can you be so accurate? Are you just working out how old you were when you got your first one?
Well, we've had cats literally from the moment that, all the way through when I was born.
Okay.
I was actually named after one of our cats as well.
Well, your mum and dad named you after one of their cats?
Well, yeah, they named me after a cat that actually was hit by a car a year before I was born. So I've never really asked them why they did that.
And I mean, has that affected you, do you think? Do you carry that thought with you a lot? I mean, Tim's quite an odd name for a cat as well. Timothy. Oh, no, it isn't. We had a cat called Timothy as well, actually, back in the day. Timmy, we called him.
Yeah, I've never been called Timmy. Yeah, so that's how I know. Just lots of experience.
Oh, absolutely fascinating.
Cats.
Round of applause for Tim. Thank you. 1242 03456060973. So we've done the cats, we've done the bi-weekly. A few complaints about the wind question. Max says, could you please not put such vulgar questions on around lunchtime? Some of us are about to eat. Well, if you're about to eat, Max, you should be doubly interested in this question because you'll be finding out why, when you are done with your eating, some gases come this way and other gases go that way. 03456060973. The referee and umpire question. Come on. Is it something to do with French? Is it the languages, the original languages in which the sports were played? We've done the beer, so we've got time for a couple more questions. What have I written down? Coins. Oh, and the coins question. Crikey, I forgot about that. Is it illegal to mutilate currency? Is it illegal to mutilate currency? And if it is, how come those machines at tourist attractions allow you to pay a quid to sort of mash up a penny and stamp a little motif on it or a slogan on it? Charlotte's in Portsmouth. Charlotte, question or answer?
Answer.
Carry on.
It's about the coin question.
Oh.
We were recently visiting the Spinnaker Tower in Portsmouth and wanted to do one of the penny coins.
Yes.
And they had a little sign on it explaining that it's no longer illegal because of the Coinage Act, where there's now an exception for these tourist attractions.
Really?
So for these certain things, there's now exceptions, which is why it's legal to do those.
Do we know when that came in?
I think it was around the 70s.
Gosh. And prior to that, it was illegal, but post that, it's not illegal there. So they must have had lots of questions about it, and they decided to put up a little sign.
Yeah, I thought it was really sweet because we'd done different ones at the different museums all day, but that was the only one that had a little explanation as to why it wasn't illegal.
Yeah, that's nice. We've got a bunch of them at home now as well. They are quite sweet, you know, but they're not. It's a weird one, Charlotte, because they're nice commemorative sort of trinkets, but they've got absolutely nothing to do with the place that you visited. They're all identical, except for having stamped on it where you went, which isn't what you'd call a souvenir in the traditional sense, is it?
Yeah, but I think it's really nice that you have a little coin that's got the symbol where you visited.
No,
And then they all look the same, but they're like a little collection.
Yes, yeah, you're right. My youngest has got loads of them, actually. She'll be delighted when I go home and bore her rigid with all the discoveries that we've made about why it is now permissible, although I find it absolutely fascinating. And it's earned you a round of applause, Charlotte.
Thank you.
No, thank you. Lovely stuff. If I can persuade the producer, a week tomorrow from 12, which is my last hour before a well-deserved, I'm sure he'll agree, holiday, I want to do rubbish tourist attractions because Rachel Venables, I don't know if you heard her today on The Breakfast Show with Tom Swarbrick, was down at this ludicrous mound that they've built at Marble Arch. God only knows why. They've spent £2 million on a mound of earth, which originally they were going to charge you to walk up. I presume so you can take Insta pictures, Instagram pictures at the top of it or something like that. So they were originally going to charge you to walk up it. Absolutely nobody was interested in that particular offer. So now it's free. But, of course, even though it's free, it's still rubbish. And it just reminded me, I think it was in Great Yarmouth. Wasn't there a waxworks museum in Great Yarmouth that was absolutely appalling? And it was so appalling, they didn't even pretend not to be appalling. They just changed the wigs on the waxwork. So the waxwork originally didn't look anything like... So say it was Prince William one summer, and then David Beckham became really famous. So they just changed the wig, and it was David Beckham the next summer. I think it was in Great Yarmouth. I could be wrong. So we might, because we don't very often allow ourselves to go full shallow end on the programme, full silly, but we might a week tomorrow for the final hour, depending on what else is going on. We might have a look at the worst, the most ridiculous tourist attraction you have ever visited. Because Charlotte there is speaking about some lovely tourist attractions and reminding me about the thought we'd had of going in precisely the opposite direction. It's 12:46.
This is LBC Mystery Hour with James O'Brien. Call 0345 6060973.
12:50 is the time. Squeezing a couple more questions, looking also for some answers, chiefly to the question about wind. How does it know which way to go, up or down? Referees and umpires. Done the coins, I think that's it. Gary's in Boston, in Lincolnshire. Gary, question or answer?
Question, please, James.
Carry on, Gary.
When you're defusing a bomb...
Oh, yeah.
Does it matter which wire you cut first?
I like that question. Because I've often thought, watching Bond films and stuff like that, that if it really was the case that you can tell which one to cut first by colour, then a clever bomb maker would just change it around, wouldn't they?
Yeah, never thought of that, but
so,
yes.
So does it... What have you got planned, Gary? Got a big weekend on the horizon, have you? What are you up to? Why do you want to know this? What's the real reason? What's the real reason?
I'm not defusing any bombs this particular weekend.
Okay.
But you never know.
You never know, do you? That's the point about being in bomb disposal. You never know when the next call's going to come, but you need to do some swatting up before you go out to the scene. We shall find out for you. When you are defusing a bomb, does it matter which wire you cut first? 0345 6060 973, which I don't know if it speaks to the younger generation, that one, in the way that it speaks to my generation. It's almost an anxiety dream. Andrew is in Manchester. Andrew, question or answer?
So it's an answer.
Carry on, Andrew.
So it's the answer to the one about flatulence. I do apologise to anyone eating their lunch.
It's only Max. Max is the only one too squeamish to deal with bodily functions at lunchtime. Carry on.
So it really comes down to thinking of your gut as from your mouth to your tail end as one long pipe.
Yes.
And throughout that pipe, there's a couple of sort of stations of valves of muscle that stop things moving backwards and forwards.
Oh, yes.
So between your stomach and your small intestine, there's a muscle called the pylorus. And the air that we ingest when we eat, your stomach will keep that and will send out backwards as a burp.
Yes.
And then as food moves through and it's digested and the bacteria in your colon digest it, you'll produce gas. That won't be able to move backwards in most people between the colon and small intestine and will come out as a little drool.
So burps are air that you've ingested while eating rather than gases that are released by the food being broken down?
Predominantly.
And the stuff that goes in the other direction is, which would also explain, not to put too fine a point on it, why burps don't smell as bad as the other emissions.
Yeah, yeah.
That's such a beautiful answer. What was it called again? The pyola?
The pylorus, that's the muscle between your stomach and small intestine.
Pylorus.
And then the ileocecal valve is the one between the small intestine and the large intestine.
And so they're a bit like, you know, I mean, on the where you can squeeze something and the water won't come back into it. I forget what they call it. Valves,
yeah,
I suppose.
Essentially.
Yeah,
yeah,
I love that. What are your qualifications? What are your qualifications, Andrew?
I'm a bowel surgeon.
Haven't you got better things to do than ring me up and answer? That's a beautiful answer. It's a supreme qualification. There wouldn't be anybody in the world better qualified than you to answer that question, then, would there, really?
No, I suppose not.
I mean, unfortunately, there are too many bowel surgeons in the world to earn you a Ray Liotta, but you certainly get a gold-plated round of applause.
Oh, thank you.
No, thank you. Can I ask you a question?
Of course.
Don't laugh. Promise you won't laugh?
Yeah, sure.
And I don't want to get... I've started drinking occasionally, or not occasionally, quite regularly, fermented goat's milk in the mornings, and I'm convinced it's improved my digestion and my overall health. Is that likely, or am I kidding myself?
There's a lot of research coming out about our gut flora and how that impacts yes. our wider health, and it could be the drinking that is changing the microbiome that, of the bugs that live in your gut.
Yes.
So potentially.
Oh, that's a really. Here's the thing. I mean, you might want to take this for a lecture or something like that. I don't know if you're keen to make some progress academically. I don't seem to have had hangovers since I started drinking fermented goat's milk in the mornings.
I don't know about that one. You've reached the limit of my knowledge.
Oh, wow, same here. So I just thought I'd let you know, because, you know, if it pops up at a big important medical symposium, you can be ahead of the curve there, Andrew. I'd want to give you that.
Potentially.
Just let me know how you get on. Coming up to 12:55, you're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Mystery Hour continues. Bradley is in Leicester. Bradley, question or answer?
Answer.
Carry on.
Which wire do you cut first in a bomb?
Yeah.
So the first thing you have to do is to disconnect the power supply. The way IEDs are initiated is you have a small power supply and you have this, it's called explosive chain. Yeah. You start off with a very small, tiny explosion, something like a spark. It can be created from a short circuit or from like the flint on a lighter.
Right.
That then initiates a slightly bigger explosion. It usually goes onto a, what's called detonation cord.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the detonation cord, you have the big main charge, which is like the big part of the bomb.
So it's like a chain reaction, then?
Yes, that's right, explosive chain. So the first thing you need to do is to disconnect that power supply that's going to be there that will create the very first, like, beginning part of the explosive chain.
So the first thing you need to do is establish where the power source is and the wire coming out of that.
Yeah, yeah. And then what you would do is, in real life, you would then set up something we call a shot, which will have something like a scalpel on the end,
yeah.
And you basically, it's highly pressurized water, because you can't, you have to use water. And then that'll you walk backwards and then you'll fire it, and that'll basically, the scalpel will just go straight through all of those connections and disconnect them. And if anything goes wrong, that's why you set that up and then you walk back to a safe place. You do that remotely. So anything you see in films where they've sort of got, like, you know, red, blue, green wires, yeah. I mean, that's just mostly, I think, just done for drama.
Showbiz. Was it ever the case, do you think? Was it ever a bit more relevant than it is now, the red, blue, green business?
I mean, it could have been. You get a lot more sophisticated IEDs that can be made.
Of course.
I think the Oklahoma bomb was very sophisticated and was actually made by someone who was a bomb disposal expert himself.
What are your qualifications, Bradley? I think I know.
So I served in 11 EOD regiment, including tour of Afghanistan. But our team dealt with 55 IEDs over the 6-month period.
Oh, you've made me go a bit funny, mate. I mean, that must be incredibly hard work, incredibly stressful work.
Yes, it is. But it's always good to once you're out of grand, you know.
It must be.
Yeah.
I'd like to give you a Ray Liotta, but only if you feel it's appropriate. It's the highest honour I can bestow upon a caller to this programme.
Okay. I mean, I have to just say that I was not the actual bomb disposal expert. I was part of the three-man team. But we all get trained up on exactly what you do anyway.
A typical soldier, already trying to pass the credit on to his comrades.
I'm Ray Liotta, and you're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. If you build it, they will come.
And a round of applause for Bradley. Great, thank you, mate. That's one of the. I can't remember the last time an answer to mystery I sent a shiver down my spine, but you just did. Thank you for that, and for everything you do. Whew, Stuart's in Canterbury. Stuart, question or answer?
It's an answer, James.
Carry on, Stuart. You've got a minute, otherwise Sheila will start getting antsy.
Okay, right. It's an answer to the sports question: the difference between a referee and an umpire.
Yes.
The answer is pretty simple, really. A referee, like football, rugby, etc. There's only one of you on the pitch. An umpire, there's always two or more.
Even in hockey?
Especially in hockey.
Oh.
Yep.
Are you serious? It really is that simple?
It's that simple.
How many umpires are there in hockey?
Two.
Are there really?
Yep.
Don't know why my voice went up several octaves. I also looked at Sheila Fogarty, which is a bit sexist, isn't it? Why would she know more about hockey than she does about rugby league, for example?
She probably would have done years ago.
Well, there you go. You're joining in now. Things have changed. All right, round of qualifications.
I'm a hockey umpire.
Round of applause. Is there a senior umpire, or are you both equal?
You're both equal. Both umpires.
Well, that's interesting. You live and learn.
It depends on the league. But James, before I go, can I just say a special thank you to that guy who worked at the bomb disposal, because he dug people like that have dug me out of the poo in the past a few times.
Are you joking?
No, I'm being deadly serious.
Oh man, you've just set me off again, haven't you? So you're literally on hold.
Yep.
Listening to somebody who would have defused or been in the team that defused IEDs when you were on a tour of duty.
Highly likely.
It's been quite a show today, Stuart. Thank you, mate. That is not really how Miss Chat normally ends, but goodness me. Thank you for everything you do, both of you. That's it from me for another day. We'll do it all again tomorrow morning from 10. I don't know why I got so emotional all of a sudden, but I'm happy to be handing over to Sheila Fogarty.